Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Fertility Answers podcast. I'm Neil Chappell and excited to have with me Dr. Mindy Bowie here today. It is Breast Cancer Awareness Month in October, so I thought this was an appropriate time to have a conversation that may not necessarily apply as much as the PCOS talk, but I still think is a really valuable piece of the fertility world to talk about, and that is fertility preservation in the face of cancer diagnosis. Dr. Bowie is a surgeon that's trained in specifically breast surgery for breast cancer patients, but I imagine sees all kinds of things. Talked to a whole bunch of folks, and my perspective on fertility preservation is fairly limited to the folks that I see specifically to talk about things. So I thought it would be useful to bring in someone that's kind of on the front lines of these conversations to help us with framing how to think about fertility preservation, pregnancy options, family building options when dealing at the same time with a cancer diagnosis. So I'm very grateful for you to carve out some time in between surgery and clinic to chat with us, and look forward to a quick conversation.
Thank you so much for having me here.
What we can start off with first is just talking about, you know, I kind of mentioned PCOS is a really, really common problem. Maybe malignancy is not so common, but from my understanding, it's up to 250,000 patients of reproductive age are diagnosed with cancer a year. That's still a lot of people that need these conversations. So I imagine you're a fairly busy person, and I would be interested in hearing your perception of just how big of a problem cancer is and where we're going and kind of where is the field nowadays with patients.
Sure. Absolutely. So we know that breast cancer is the most common cancer in women in America other than skin cancers. It's the second leading cause of cancer-related death in women. We know that 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer in their lifetime. It is so common. Anyone listening to this, I guarantee you know somebody or have a family member that have been diagnosed with breast cancer. But again, that 1 in 8 number is very important, because that doesn't mean that 1 in 8 women looking around in their 30s would have breast cancer. This is a lifetime risk.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at average women in their 20s, 30s, having children, reproductive years. In the 30s, we're looking at like about 1 in 233 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer. But that is still a significant number.
Less than 1%, but but that's a lot. That's a lot of people.
Absolutely.
That's a lot of people that you get to talk to.
Absolutely. And again, it's important to for these people to know their options if they are diagnosed with breast cancer and are interested in fertility preservation or having children in the future.
Well, the important kind of side note that emphasizes that is the fact that I'm very proud of my oncology colleagues. You guys have done fantastic work in the past few decades in survival and treatment options and how well patients have done. So that 1 in 233 women that are diagnosed, they come out of this on the other side and they've got a whole life to live. And so that kind of brings into question, are we making sure that we're taking care of mental health, overall well-being, and fertility comes into play? When you first sit down with a patient after their diagnosis and talk about their treatment plan and kind of what the next steps are, what are some of the important factors that you touch on when you have that conversation? What does that conversation look like on your first visit?
So when I'm first diagnosing a patient with cancer, my conversation with a lady in her 60s or 70s is going to be very different than my conversation of a newly diagnosed breast cancer in her 30s or 40s, or 20s, 30s, and 40s. So in my conversations with those that are of reproductive age, we're going to talk about things such as, is there going to be a need for chemotherapy? Are you hormone receptor positive? You know, hormones play a lot of role in reproduction. We have to address that. I often look at their history and or talk to them about their children. How many children do they have? What are their goals? Are they done with their childbearing years? Is this something that we need to address prior? Because the time to address that is before you start treatment, especially if chemotherapy is going to be involved. There's so many places out there, and I'm not talking about just Louisiana, in America, even in larger cities, that these ladies are never even given these options, never even having conversations with regards to their fertility preservation in conjunction with their breast cancer treatment.
That is what the literature shows, is that many folks are not comfortable having fertility conversations but the fertility conversations are very important. Yes. But to your point, having folks in kind of each of the aspects of care, having someone that you can go to for mental health and well-being, having someone to talk about the genetics of the cancer and what that may mean for their future risk and for their offspring, and then having someone talk about fertility options is pretty big. I'm with you. I look at their history. Some of the important things to think about when you're thinking about fertility preservation: how young you are, that impacts your response to treatment. If you've got kids before, I say it's a really common thing that I hear patients when I sit down and say, I have my two or three kids, I'm good, I'm just going to attack this cancer, I'm going to handle one thing at a time, versus someone that maybe hasn't had children yet, wants that in their future, they may have a different set of motivations, and that's something that patients definitely consider. Whether or not they have a partner determines options for treatment that we can talk about and what their goals are. Some folks are open to parenthood, some folks are determined for parenthood, and those are obviously two different motivational sets as well. One thing I think is important to ask about too is, have you ever had issues with fertility in the past? Many folks have never had fertility treatments. They don't know if they have any issues with fertility or not. Some folks show up and say, I have this new breast cancer diagnosis. By the way, I've already been through a couple IVF cycles with my partner because we were having this. So you already know you have another hill that you got to think about. And then I totally agree with you. You got to be thinking about the other aspects of care, bringing in genetics to talk about why you're in that 1 in 230. Is there something going on with things like BRCA or CHK1 or CHK2 or any of those other mutations that's kind of alphabet soup that puts you at increased risk? Those genes can also be passed on to your offspring, and you want to make sure that you're screening for those. I want to talk a little bit about some of the fertility preservation options just as a kind of an informational purpose, without trying to go into too much detail about any one thing, because I really want to pick your brain about some of the more common myths, misconceptions, or points that you like to drive home when you see patients. But to briefly go over the fertility options that are available to patients that you and I both work with together, probably the mainstay of treatment is egg or embryo freezing. Dr. Leisinger and I touched on freezing eggs and embryos in a prior podcast, and we still need to talk more about that in one to follow, I promise. But essentially, that's going through an IVF cycle to obtain eggs from someone that's already having cycles. So this is someone that's already gone through puberty. And we can either freeze eggs or freeze embryos if they have a partner. This takes a couple of weeks. And to your point, you want to do this before you start treatment. But most of the studies these days show that with the advances in IVF protocols that we have, you actually don't need to delay your treatment. So the average time it takes to get eggs or embryos to freeze is 2 or 3 weeks. What's the average time it takes to get someone into your clinic and plan for surgery and start chemo? What is that timeline
typically? So I would tell you, if they're going to be doing chemotherapy first, they're going to need a port. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to need chemo teaching, and then they're going to need echo. There's all this workup that has to occur before chemotherapy can start. Mm-hmm. That workup is usually 2 to 3 weeks.
Yep, and we can work simultaneously.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I have absolutely scheduled egg retrievals around port placements.
Yes.
And in fact, some of our patients, in fact, have. But I'll remember, she's going to have her port placed at 3 o'clock that afternoon. Well, we can do the egg retrieval that morning, and then she'll have plenty of time to just bebop over to that surgery center and take care of it. The newer stuff in the field is ovarian tissue cryopreservation. This is some really exciting stuff. It no longer has the experimental label, and it's about... it's a very interesting option for patients that haven't started cycling yet, where we actually go in through surgery and take some of the ovarian tissue away. We strip what's called the cortex of the ovary, which part of the skin of the ovary that houses the eggs that are in hibernation, and we freeze that. You can then take that out and then and keep it frozen until someone's gone through their treatments, and then put it back when they're ready to try reproducing. There's a few limitations that are worth mentioning. This is not to prevent menopause. The longest lifespan of this transplanted tissue is roughly 7 years. While no longer experimental, there are a limited number of births, just a little over 100 births that have been reported. And there's still concerns that when you're putting the tissue back, you may be reseeding cancer cells depending on the diagnosis. So the option of ovarian tissue cryopreservation is still very, very, very new and has pros and cons. But it is worth mentioning because it is kind of an exciting development in the field. There's another medication that y'all very commonly use called Lupron mm-hmm. that essentially drops the communication between the brain and the ovary and puts the ovary into somewhat of a hibernation state. And this may protect the ovary somewhat from any chemotherapy. The chemotherapy mostly works by attacking cells that are dividing rapidly, and that's why it preferentially targets cancer cells. And so the Lupron, by basically slowing the ovary down, may protect. There are some really promising studies out there that show benefit. There are some other studies that don't show as much benefit. So the answer is not clear cut that there is a major benefit to Lupron, and it should not be used necessarily in place of egg or embryo freezing, but it certainly is a nice adjunct to offer patients that has several other side effect benefits as well. And I think that the other thing to mention from the standpoint of chemotherapy is if in fact a patient does undergo chemotherapy treatment, etc., and does become infertile or even menopausal from toxic exposure from the chemotherapy, there are always things like donor egg, donor embryo, surrogacy, gestational carrier, adoption options that we go into with all patients. Because some, and I've had plenty of patients say, I really appreciate all the information. This is too much for me to decide right now. The cancer is my focus. If I want to have kids in the future, I know I've got that as a fallback plan. And that's almost always true. I think that the one exception is radiation treatment. Radiation treatment to the uterus does have concerns for long-term increased risk of complication with pregnancy. But with the exception of pelvic radiation, to your point, most of the treatments that we use and most of the cancer diagnoses that we deal with, they don't really have any risks as far as long-term risk for future pregnancies. And with survival rates being fantastic because you guys are good at your job, pregnancy is a very real option. Motherhood is a very real option for these patients.
I just want to make a point that having you guys on board and how important it is, because whenever I am talking to a patient about a new diagnosis of breast cancer, I'm talking to them about surgery, chemotherapy, possibly radiation therapy, genetic testing, mm-hmm. reconstructive options, and then all of a sudden we have to start talking about fertility. And all that patient is thinking about in that conversation is, I have cancer. I have cancer. So it's really difficult for her to focus on things such as fertility options because mm-hmm. she is at this point concerned. She doesn't know her prognosis. Mm-hmm. What's going through her mind is, how could I think about children, having children, because I don't even know if I'm going to be here. Mm-hmm. So we really try to slow down a little bit, take a little time to explain to the patient how the course of things can work. And then that's when you guys really can come in, because when they're having the conversation with us, it's all cancer, cancer, cancer. But then when they start to hear a different perspective, hear details about fertility preservation and how many options they do have, mm-hmm. I think they can understand it so much more than that conversation, that initial conversation, and all they can focus on is cancer at that time.
Yeah, that most of the organizations that talk about how to talk about this, they're very simple. They take 13 pages in their papers and recommendations, but it's very simple. You just say, this may affect fertility. Do you want to know more?
Yeah.
And then if they say yes, okay, we'll set up that conversation. And so most reproductive endocrinologists around the country will say, you call me with a cancer diagnosis, I'll see them within 24 hours. And we're happy to do it. It is an overwhelming conversation. And I see the same thing. I'll sit down with a patient and say, we can talk about IUI, we can talk about IVF, we can talk about donor, we can talk about this, talk about that. And then at some point they're like, you talk way too much. That's too many options. It's too many things to think about. And I can't imagine that that's not the case, if not more so, on a day where they have to talk about surgery, chemo, radiation, et cetera. So I think there is a place for having this as a separate devoted conversation to this topic, just like mental health, just like genetics, just like chemo teaching. All of those things to say, you've got a big hurdle to jump over. Here are all the steps that we're going to take to get you through. That's why I said, this may not affect everybody that's listening, but there are important nuggets inside the way we think about this particular diagnosis that are important for a lot of people. Okay. Just pausing and saying, like you said, how does this affect fertility? How does this affect my mental health? How does this affect my family? Should my sisters, my brothers, my mother, my aunt, should they be concerned? Should they be tested? Should they be followed up, etc.? The other thing I didn't mention that I should have in treatment options is we can add medications in the stimulation to decrease exposure of estrogen to any hormone-sensitive tissues that we may be concerned about. Although the research has pretty overwhelmingly shown that IVF, pregnancy, etc., doesn't really have a major effect on prognosis in patients that have cancer these days. So, you know, we used to be very, very afraid of estrogen in patients that have breast cancer, even estrogen receptor or progesterone receptor positive breast cancer, but it doesn't seem to have any prognosis or any effect on the prognosis for these patients. And so we're a lot more comfortable with that nowadays, and that we've been given a lot of reassuring data from some very studious researchers across the world on that front, thankfully.
Absolutely.
Thankfully. I guess in conclusion, I think we've really gained a lot of how to tackle this and how to think about it from a broad point of view. Mm-hmm. Are there myths, misconceptions, misperceptions, or any kind of common points that you see when you talk to a patient in clinic that you want to highlight for folks?
I think you just hit the nail on the head whenever you said what our data is now showing, how safe these procedures can be, because for the longest time we didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing that I want to point out is how important that multidisciplinary approach is to this. Now, again, I'm usually the first person seeing the patient, yeah, telling them all of these, you know, and I'm talking about all of the above, the surgery, the chemo, the radiation, the genetics, the reconstruction, the fertility, but I try to highlight the major points of it and then let them know you're going to hear more about this when you see the medical oncologist,
mm-hmm,
or you're going to hear more about this when you see the reproductive endocrinologist. But just so I'm planting the seed in their head,
yeah,
and then let the experts in those particular areas allow, you know, expand upon what we can offer to them. I think taking it in piecemeal aspects like that just helps the patient to understand more, helps them to feel like they're really getting a multidisciplinary approach, that they have a team of doctors,
mm-hmm,
taking care of them rather than an individual doctor or a few individual doctors. So I think that multidisciplinary approach to this is so important.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fun conversation. I think that, like I said, it's been helpful to kind of understand a little bit more about how other folks in this team think and what you see. I hope it's been helpful to help frame questions and thoughts and just kind of bridge concepts for listeners. If anybody has any feedback or thoughts, you can reach us at podcast@fertilityanswers.com. But until next time, I'll see you next month. Thanks, everyone.